clouds with highs in the mid-60s to lower 70s. These are just some of the stories making news headlines around the world at this hour. I'm Lori Bongard.
Journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, April 4th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Zimbabwe's elections yield uncertainty. Will Mugabe step down or not? Hundreds of activists gather in Memphis to work toward a green economy for all in Dr. King's name. And a new report on the oppression of Bedouin Arabs in Israel.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party held a Politburo meeting today to discuss the nation's elections this past weekend. This as hundreds of pro-Mugabe war veterans took to the streets of Harare. Last Saturday, Zimbabweans went to the polls casting their votes in one of the most pivotal elections in the recent history of the African nation. The political atmosphere there has remained tense as official results in the three-way presidential race have not been released. Fearful of tampering, civil society organizations in Zimbabwe have signed on to a petition demanding that the Southern African Development Community and the African Union pressure for the release of all electoral results immediately. ZANU-PF party officials have said that current President Robert Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe for the past 28 years, is ready for a runoff election against his presumed Movement for Democratic Change rival, Morgan Tsvangirai, should presidential results declare the necessity of a second round. Tsvangirai's MDC party has already claimed an outright presidential victory, as official results from the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission has noted that opposition parties won a majority of seats in the parliament for the first time in three decades. If a runoff presidential election were to be deemed necessary, the contest would have to take place within the next 3 weeks. My guest this morning is Briggs Bamba. He is a program associate for public education and mobilization at Africa Action, and he's just returned from a two-week trip to Zimbabwe. Welcome to Uprising, Briggs.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us today. You've been blogging from Zimbabwe and have really been in the country at a very, very important time. I want to, of course, spend the majority of our interview talking about what's recently happened in Zimbabwe. But first, I want to play for you and our listeners an excerpt of an interview that Robert Mugabe gave Steve Talbot in February 1979 at KPFA Pacifica Radio, and he talked, of course, about the Zimbabwe at that time, the current political context and his role in it. I want to play this excerpt for you and then ask you to contextualize Mugabe in Zimbabwe's history. Let's take a listen.
We believe that in a war such as our own, where you must draw upon every resource because the enemy's resources are ample, you got to utilize the energies of all those persons, either operating as groups or as individuals, who believe in the same cause as yourself. And we believe that the basis of these solidarity groups is the acceptance and espousal of our cause as their cause, and hence the solidarity that exists between them and ourselves. We would appreciate it very much if their work extended in scope, that their strategy became intensified and improved over the year, especially in 1979, during which year we would like to intensify our struggle. We would expect that in as much as organizing material aid of a humanitarian kind, that is, organizing food, clothing, medicaments, educational facilities, and transport for us, they will also carry some political work to educate the ordinary American citizen on the justice of our struggle. And I'm sure this is work which can promote a greater understanding of our cause on the part of the American people. We are misunderstood in that part of the world, but we believe that we are fighting for a democratic society, for the same liberties as the American people enjoy. We are fighting to overthrow a system based on racism, to establish equality. We are fighting for the removal of the undemocratic character of our society so it can be replaced by a full democracy. We are fighting not for individualism, but for the general interest of the people. And this is a struggle we believe all the solidarity movements would want to see succeed. We are very grateful for your efforts. Please keep up the good work. And remain assured that we always have you in our minds. You are our ear. We are operating on the front, and the front cannot succeed without that rear. Thank you.
That's the voice of Robert Mugabe speaking to Steve Talbert at KPFA Pacifica Radio 29 years ago, only 1 year before he became president of Zimbabwe. And now, 29 years later, after this interview, he may be facing the end of his presidency. It remains to be seen. Briggs Bamba, before we talk about what's just happened, can you contextualize Mugabe's presidency for our listeners? What did he symbolize 28 years ago when he first came to power, and how has his leadership changed since then?
I think the time that, you know, he made that very eloquent speech on, international solidarity at the height of the liberation struggle, Mugabe represented the, you know, the pinnacle of the nationalist leadership and the struggle against colonialism then. And if you go to 1980 and the coming in of independence, the new state that was institutionalized then did quite a lot of, you know, tremendous work in expanding healthcare, expanding access to education, and including, you know, the broader majority of the black population that had been excluded in the colonial enterprise, you know, from the economy, from, you know, access to services and things like that. But then when you go to 1990, from my point of view, that's where you begin to see, a very big problem, in the sense that in 1990, Mugabe embraced the neoliberal economic project. He embraced the IMF, he embraced the World Bank, and the policies that he implemented then, which were known then as the economic structural adjustment programs, these were policies that meant privatization of education, privatization of healthcare. So the gains that had been accrued in the first 10 years of independence, you know, were reversed. You started to have hundreds of thousands of workers being retrenched because of restructuring that was happening in parastatals, and because the borders were being opened and local industry could not compete. So you had the textile industry laying off thousands of workers, and Mugabe presided over the implementation of this project. And, of course, these are projects that, world over, have sparked social resistance and social struggles. And when this happened, Mugabe did not pause to listen to the voice of the people, you know, what they wanted, how they were suffering as a result of the worsening economic situation. But what he did instead was to completely close off democratic space. That's when he started in the late 90s to introduce draconian legislation such as the Access to Information Protection of Privacy Act, the security laws that were very draconian and similar to the ones that had been used by the colonial regime. So he basically sought to use those measures to contain a resistance that was rising up against a worsening economic situation that, as I have, you know, laid out, had come primarily from the failure of economic structure adjustment programs, but also from the failure of the 1980 transition itself that if we have a few more minutes on your program, we might be able to talk about.
Let's talk about the election first. You were just in Zimbabwe during this past election. How did this election compare to previous elections in terms of access to ballots and violence, etc.?
So this was the freest ever election in the history of Zimbabwe, since it became a state. But at the same time, there were a lot of problems. And when I say it was the freest, I'm referring to, a number of the issues that came as a result of the dialogue that was facilitated through the Southern African Development Community, and facilitated by President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa. And one of the issues that came out of that, is equal access to media by all contesting parties, to state media. And there were issues of the fact that the results after voting has happened at a polling station, the ballots don't have to be transported anywhere. Counting happens at the polling station, and as soon as that is done, the results are posted at the polling station for everyone to go there and be able to inspect and see how that that happened. So there's really no chance that there can be manipulation going up, because the results from every polling station are posted on a public space, and everyone can go there, record. Different political parties have had their agencies there collecting those figures, and they've been able to do their own tabulations. So you had, the opposition being able to access the state media. You also had people walking freely on the street. A Zanu-PF person would wear their T-shirts and they would walk around in the high density of suburbs of Harare, which are mostly, opposition strongholds. And similarly, the opposition activists were also able to wear their T-shirts in rural areas where you have mostly, Zanu-PF supporters. So, and there was really no violence. Cases of violence that were reported were very, very isolated and did not really have a bearing on what was happening. But there were still a lot of, problems that one could still cite, particularly the fact that in the run-up to the election, you had the service chiefs, particularly the commander of the National Army and the commissioner of the prison services and the commissioner of the police. They all came out and said they will not salute anyone other than Mugabe in this election. In a way, this was meant to, it can be interpreted as intimidation of the electorate, because they are saying this a few days before people cast their vote, and it has also been interpreted as a coup threat in the event that Mugabe loses the election. And the other issue as well, especially with the media, was that the state media remained very partisan. So whereas the opposition is getting coverage, most of the coverage that the opposition was getting was coverage that was, in most part abusive, and in very many ways misrepresenting to what the opposition was trying to communicate to the electorate at that particular time. And that the opposition that the incumbent system was getting, was coverage that was more of, promoting what has happened. And then the last thing that I want to mention is that, Zimbabwe has had the contestation of power and the direction in which the country moves in Zimbabwe for the past century has been marked by a lot of violence. The colonial state itself was a violent, knob-carry-wielding state, and that brooked, no democratic impulse at all. And even the mobilization that the nationalist movement had itself was, for the most part, very coercive, and it involved employing violence. So people still have memories going back 3 decades ago of violence associated with the political process. So you have a lot of people shying away from the political process because they associate it with violence. So people do not necessarily feel that, my expression, I have a right to go out, express myself, and nothing will happen to me. And to some extent, this is why you also keep seeing the turnout not being, even at a moment when things are this difficult, you do not have a turnout that is as high as it should be.
Briggs, I have several more questions for you, but not much time left, so I'm going to try to ask you as quick as I can. Briggs Bamba is my guest. He's a program associate for public education and mobilization at Africa Action. Let's talk about what really the election outcome has been. We've been seeing some noise in the media that Mugabe was considering stepping down, but then it turned out he wanted a runoff election. What do you think is really going on?
The election result that we have so far is the parliamentary election in which the opposition has won the majority for the very first time since independence, and there is total secrecy surrounding the presidential ballot. And ZEC, which is the Zimbabwe Election Commission, is now undermining the credibility of whatever they are going to announce as the outcome of the presidential election, because 5 years after that, they haven't said anything. But when you look at the voting patterns in the parliamentary election, it shows a very, very close contest. And the Constitution requires that for anyone to be declared a winner, they must have 50% plus one vote. So it does not appear that anyone got that. And I think Morgan Tsvangirai was very close to getting that, but I think he's still a few votes shy of that. So what's most likely to happen really is a runoff or a second, round of elections where President Mugabe will face MDC President Morgan Tsvangirai in the second round.
Let's talk about some of the grassroots organizations you met with while you were in Zimbabwe. What role are they playing? What role is civil society playing in Zimbabwe's political arena at this point?
So the main thing that our civic society was doing for the time that I was in Zim was to try as hard as possible to ensure a free and fair election environment before the March 29 ballot. So the civic society mobilized thousands of local observers who were posted even in remote polling stations, recording what was happening and witnessing the whole process. And civic society also did a lot of advocacy work to try and highlight the issues or the impediments to a free, fair, and democratic election. Civic society was making presentations to, the SADC observer missions that were there, the African Union observer missions, and raising a lot of concerns, that they were identifying and that they felt, impeded a free democratic expression. But to a very large extent, civic society in Zimbabwe right now is allied to the movement for democratic change, which is, the opposition. Mm. So some of their work actually involved really mobilization for the movement for democratic change, which a lot of the civic groups seem to believe that carries, at least the possibility of opening up democratic space in Zimbabwe and then allowing people to engage in various issues around, economic progress or economic justice, depending on which angle of civil society you are looking at. So there was that mobilization. There was a lot of voter education and the encouragement of people to go out and vote and express themselves. And a lot of advocates work as well.
Finally, Briggs, you went across the border to Mozambique while you were in Zimbabwe. What's happening with Zimbabweans who are the immigrants or refugees in Mozambique?
Yeah, so the first thing that I would like to quickly mention is that this is a very, very ironic story, because if you remember going way back, Mozambicans were the immigrants in Zimbabwe, and they're doing all sorts of manual jobs, working on farms, housekeeping, and things like that. But when you go to Mozambique right now, you have a flood of Zimbabweans, especially from the Manica area, and a lot of them are working as, coming in as mechanics. You have Zimbabweans working in as teachers, and you also have especially the young, unskilled young women working in as commercial sex workers in Mozambique. And I had an opportunity to visit you know, places where they were staying, and it's very deplorable conditions. People are living in a huge block where you don't even have any privacy, and you just have your, you know, your blankets and everything on the floor, and, you know, for as little as an equivalent of a quarter here, you know, those young girls are selling their bodies. It was a very, you know, deplorable state of affairs there. And one of the issues we wanted to also observe was to see if there was going to be a huge influx of Zimbabweans coming back to vote, because I was there a day before the elections. And I would not, you know, even the people we talked to at the border did not really say that there was a really high volume of people trekking back to go and vote. And maybe this also explains why, you know, the voter turnout remained low. It sort of speaks to the number of people who have left the country.
And also, very briefly, Briggs, what role do you think the United States should be playing at this time, given, of course, the U.S.'s rocky relationship with Mugabe's regime over the years?
I think there are two roles. From the people-to-people solidarity level, I believe that the United States, social organizations and individuals need to identify principles and values that they believe are worth supporting in Zimbabwe, especially democratic values, and establish ways of, you know, lifting up the communities and the individuals and the groups in Zimbabwe who are advancing that cause. People are working for social justice, people are working for democracy. So establishing those people-to-people solidarity connections. And then from the U.S. government point of level, I think the best thing that they should do right now is to step back, because the very overt, aggressive and forward role that the U.S. government has played in Zimbabwe in the last, you know, 7 or so years has actually tended to undermine the credibility of the opposition as a genuine homegrown opposition, and gave Mugabe ammunition to actually characterize the opposition as a creation of Western forces, citing the U.S. role and, you know, the role by the U.K. So I would think that if the U.S. has to do any intervention, it should not be unilateral. It should be through multilateral frameworks that exist in the region and on the continent, your Southern Africa Development Community and your African Union. You know, those should be the frameworks through which the U.S. must advance its agenda, because people have to watch out as well, so that the U.S. does not overbear its influence on the opposition to the extent that you end up having an opposition that is beholden to U.S. interests at the expense of the people's interests.
Briggs Bamba, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Briggs Bamba is the Program Associate for Public Education and Mobilization at Africa Action, and you can read his blog that he had been posting from Zimbabwe at justzimbabwe.wordpress.com. That's justzimbabwe.wordpress.com. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for the clip that we heard from 1979 with Robert Mugabe's interview. You are listening to Uprising. Later in the hour, we will go live to Jerusalem to hear about a new report of oppression against Bedouin Arabs. We'll also hear this radical day in history, and after this week's Black Agenda report, we'll go to Memphis. Stay tuned. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda report. This week's commentary is about the Congo.
Five million Congolese have died in the last decade or so in order to make billionaires even richer. If there were such a thing as international law, this Holocaust in the Democratic Republic of Congo should have already resulted in the public hanging of hundreds of the world's richest men, and rightfully so. If the Nuremberg laws that sent 10 Nazis to the gallows for crimes against humanity and peace were applied to the Congo, we could quite easily find the names of the defendants in the columns of the world's financial press, the richest men on the face of the earth. These men conspired to murder millions so that there would be constant war in Central Africa, but no law to inhibit theft on the grandest industrial scale imaginable. The so-called government of Congo is just now getting around to beginning a review of which companies are mining what and where in the country. Since the many invasions of Congo began a decade ago, corporations like De Beers, DHP Billiton, Anglo Gold, and the American giant Freeport-McMoRan have caused 5 million people to die so they could use the chaos as a cover to smuggle billions of dollars in precious metals out of the country. These mining companies all have their own private armies to defend their stolen goods, or join with the armies of U.S. allied countries such as Rwanda and Uganda to establish free fire and steal whatever you can carry away zones. It is accurate to say that the Holocaust in the Congo is a collective crime by all of the Euro-American mineral extraction industries and the governments that serve them. True justice for the Congo would require the imprisonment or execution of many tens of thousands, most of them white men. The Africans involved, including Congolese officials, are relatively small fry, but they do prosper from the table scraps of the cannibalization of the Congo. According to the Commission to Review the State of Mining in Congo, various branches of the government protect some companies from paying any taxes at all on profits that range up to 600%. It's not clear who even has a contract to do business in Congo. None of the gold rushes of modern history bore any similarity to the violence of industrial capitalism scouring the earth for coltan, diamonds, and cassiterite. The Congolese death toll already exceeds those killed by forced labor under the Nazis, but not one rich white man in a suit has been punished. Congo is proof that those nations that claim to be the civilized powers of the world are in fact the opposite. They are the guardians and bankrollers of hell. While these men live, let no one dare speak of morality as anything other than a wishful hypothetical. Certainly, it does not exist anywhere in Congo. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. Forty years ago today, the greatest civil rights leader of our time, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was shot and killed by a man named James Earl Ray. It was April 4, 1968. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, when he was assassinated. He was only 39 years old. He had been in Memphis to support striking sanitation workers, and the day before his death he gave his last speech, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," at the Mason Temple in Memphis, in which he discussed the state of the movement for social and economic justice and seemed to prophesize his own end. Here is an excerpt from that speech.
Another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. Is nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today. And also in the human rights revolution, if something isn't done and done in a hurry, to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect, the whole world is doomed. Now, I'm just happy that God has allowed me to live in this period to see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that he's allowed me to be in Memphis. I can remember when Negroes were just going around, as Ralph has said so often, scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking at the Mason Temple in Memphis the day before he was killed 40 years ago. In his last year of life, he had been working on a nationwide campaign to end poverty. This weekend, to commemorate King's legacy, hundreds of community organizers and activists are gathered in Memphis for a sold-out conference called The Dream Reborn. The goal of the conference, in the words of its organizers, is to, quote, create ecological solutions to heal the earth while bringing jobs, justice, wealth, and health to all our communities. Speakers include Reverend Lennox Yearwood, Winona LaDuke, Paul Hawken, Makani Temba Nixon, and my guest, Van Jones, founder and president of Green for All, which is organizing the conference. Can you tell us what the significance is of Martin Luther King's legacy 40 years today after his assassination?
Well, obviously he went from being a victim of segregation and one of the most brutal and oppressive apartheid regimes in the history of the world to being a world-renowned hero and visionary. He was only 39 when he got killed. He's been dead for 40 years, so he's been gone longer than he was ever here, but we're still, you know, living his shadow and living his, living out his legacy and in some ways still living in the shadow of his vision, which is a drastically improved world for everybody. So, but I think that for the new generations that are coming on, we have to really update that vision. And, you know, we are living in an ecological age, an age where, you know, the environment can no longer be taken for granted. Mother Nature always bats last. And the effects of 500 years of colonization and 150 years of industrialization and burning of fossil fuels is starting to catch up to us. So if Dr. King were alive today, he would be focused on some of these environmental issues. He would say we need equal protection, as he said when he was alive. But he would say we need equal protection, meaning no more Katrinas, no more leaving our most vulnerable people to face the wrath of the environmental crisis with no help from their government. He would say we need equal opportunity, but he would say we need equal opportunity in the green economy, not just equal protection from the worst of global warming, but also equal opportunity and equal access to solar power, hybrid cars, organic food, all of the positives of the green economy, the positive of the response to the ecological crisis should be equally available to everybody. So that's why we are launching today our grassroots campaign, Green for All, greenforall.org, no numerals, all letters, to say we want to build in the United States a green economy, an inclusive green economy, not just for the eco-chic and the eco-elite, but an inclusive green economy strong enough to lift millions of people out of poverty.
So tell us exactly what's happening in Memphis, where you're at, kick off this conference, the Dream Reborn. Who's there? Who's going to be speaking? And what goals do you hope to achieve at this conference?
Well, you know, the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, which is the organization I founded 11 years ago, spun off this new organization, Green for All. Green for All is a national effort to get green-collar jobs, as we call them, green-collar jobs and opportunities to disadvantaged people. So jobs in the solar industry, jobs and opportunities, entrepreneurial opportunities in the wind industry, green construction, organic food. We spun that off from the Ella Baker Center. I'm now the full-time president of Green for All. We're doing this conference. It's called Dream Reborn, the Dream Reborn. Starting today, the 40th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, to bring people together from all over the country who share this vision. You know, there are people who are doing organic urban gardening and urban farming in Chicago. They're coming. There are people who are doing who are building green, affordable housing in Newark, New Jersey. They're coming. You know, we have people who are doing green roofs and teaching young people the tools and technology of green roofing in the South Bronx. They're coming. People who are in urban America, who are in communities of color, who are in vulnerable communities, but who picked up these ecological solutions and see them as job opportunities, opportunities to build wealth, to create entrepreneurial avenues, to build community, to increase dignity and power in our communities. These are the conference, The Dream Reborn, is really for us to get together and declare that Dr. King's dream is reborn. It's reborn in us. And this time it's not just about uplifting and honoring the people. It's also about uplifting and honoring the planet.
Van Jones, is this a conference the first time that such a gathering of such various varied and diverse groups is taking place to focus on this issue, on the environment with, with diverse communities?
Yes, it's we are very proud to say this is, to our knowledge, the first ever green conference that will be 70% plus people of color, of young people, mostly people who are working on a daily basis in vulnerable communities. Often when you think about the green economy and green politics, you think about the eco-chic and the eco-elite. Well, we are declaring the birth of a new environmental politics. We call it social uplift environmentalism. We believe the smartest way to solve the ecological problems is to give people the tools and the technology to begin solving some of the social problems, putting people to work, letting people create new businesses, new co-ops, new collectives, new opportunities that are green and clean from the inception. And we believe that with if we change the way we fuel our bodies with organic local food, created, farmed close to the people who consume that food, that you create new business opportunities, new job opportunities, new work by creating a local food system that's vibrant. We believe if you change the way you fuel your buildings, we can change the way we fuel our machines by moving from dirty oil and coal to clean solar and wind and energy conservation, then we can also create thousands of contracts, millions of jobs in retrofitting the nation. So that will let us then change the way we fuel our movement. If you change the way you fuel our bodies, we change the way we fuel our buildings and our machines, then we can change the way we fuel our movements, because we will be much more solution-oriented, positive-directed, hope-filled, and purposeful. And for too long, I feel, and many of us feel, that progressives have been kind of mourning for the 60s, when we could go out and protest our way to the changes that we wanted. We're going to have to prepare to protest, but increasingly, as the economy and the ecological context worsens, we're also going to have to prepare to govern, to take care of each other, and to take care of the earth directly. And that will be a very different kind of movement than we've seen in the past.
I'm speaking with Van Jones, the founder of the Ella Baker Center, and he's with the organization Green for All. He's joining us via cell phone from Memphis, Tennessee, where he's attending a conference called The Dream Reborn. How has the mainstream environmental movement responded to this gathering, if at all?
The gathering in particular seems to have received a lot of positive attention. I think that people who are a part of the mainstream environmental movement know that they have not succeeded as of yet expanding the coalition to include the majority of people who live in the United States. And we have been met by, you know, warm and welcome open arms, frankly, by this effort, by the Sierra Club, by the Natural Resource Defense Council, National Wildlife, the NWF. And we're happy about that, National Wildlife Fund. But much more importantly, we've been greeted with open arms by the SEIU, the retooling labor union, the only one that's really growing rapidly, which includes a lot of immigrant labor and service workers. They're excited. Many of the traditional African American church groups and leaders are excited. I'm actually here. I was here in Memphis at Al Sharpton's conference. Many civil rights groups are here in Memphis. They're excited. So we think that we are helping to birth something on April 4th, which has always been a sad day in the black community. We want to change the meaning of that date, at least in some small part, to be a date where a new movement, a Dr. King 2.0 agenda, if you will, got a little bit of traction on April the 4th, 2008.
Finally, Van Jones, you've talked a couple of times about green-collar jobs, green jobs, et cetera, within low-income communities and communities of color. What would a green economy that uplifts poor communities look like? Would it be something that coexists with the current capitalist system? Would it be an overhaul, or would it just be sort of a subset?
Well, you know, the answer to that question is yes, it'll be both. One of the things that has happened, I think, too often to progressives is that we don't understand the relationship between minimum goals and maximum goals. Right after Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, if the civil rights leaders had jumped out and said, okay, now we want reparations for slavery, we want redistribution of all wealth, and we want to legalize mixed marriages. That had been there. They had come out with a maximum program the very next day. They'd have been laughed at. Instead, they came out with a very minimum program. You know, we just want to integrate these buses. The students a few years later came out with a very minimum program. We just want to sit at the lunch counter. But inside that minimum demand was a very radical kernel that eventually meant that from 1954 to 1968, you know, complete revolution was on the table for this country. And I think that this green movement has to pursue those same steps and stages. Right now we're saying we want to move from suicidal gray capitalism to some kind of eco-capitalism where, you know, at least we're not, you know, fast-tracking the destruction of the whole planet. Will that be enough? No, it won't be enough. We want to go beyond systems of exploitation and oppression altogether. But that's a process. And I think what's great about the movement that's beginning to emerge is that the crisis is so severe in terms of joblessness, violence, and now ecological threats that people are willing to be both very pragmatic and very visionary. And so the green economy will start off as a small subset, and we're going to push it and push it and push it until it becomes the engine for transforming the whole society.
My guest has been Van Jones, founder and president of Green for All, which is organizing the conference in Memphis this weekend. For more information, visit greenforall.org. That's greenforall.org. And the conference information is at dreamreborn.org. You are listening to Uprising, and after this radical day in history, we'll go to Jerusalem to find out about home demolitions of Bedouin Arabs. Stay tuned.
KPFK listeners, the search is on for the next general manager of KPFK, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. Applications are now being accepted. For details on the skills and qualifications and information on how to apply, go to kpfk.org and click on Jobs at KPFK in the left menu. The next general manager of KPFK, go to kpfk.org.
This is your Radio Roof reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 4th, in 1859, a popular blackface minstrel show in New York called Bryant's Minstrels debuted the song I Wish I Was in Dixieland, which promoted the idea that enslaved black people were happy, content, and actually longed to be on plantations. The song became an instant hit, especially in the South, where it gave voice to the pre-Civil War sentiments of Southern whites. Just 2 years later, the Dixie Song became the battle hymn of the Southern Confederacy as they marched into civil war to defend the institution of slavery. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away. Say it, say it, say
it. Welcome back to Uprising. A report released earlier this week urged Israel to end discriminatory housing practices against Bedouin people living in villages and townships. Compiled by Human Rights Watch, the 130-page study found that the minority Arab group living in the southern Negev desert face systemic housing demolitions and unfair land policies. Declaring many Bedouin villages illegal, the Israel Land Authority has demolished more than 200 homes in 2007 alone. Human Rights Watch has also concluded that while homes in unrecognized villages are targeted for being built without permits, the state displays a willingness to construct new Negev homes for Jewish Israelis. Calling the practices unfair, the report demands that the State of Israel declare a moratorium on Bedouin housing demolitions immediately, while creating an independent commission to investigate land and housing violations. The report touches on an issue with historical roots, as some Bedouin villages were founded before the creation of Israel in 1948, while others came into existence after land displacements by the new state. Overall, thousands of Bedouin homes have been demolished since the 1970s. My guest is Joe Stork, Middle East Director at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us live from Jerusalem. Welcome, Joe.
Glad to be with you.
Tell us more about these Bedouin societies. How do they live, and what is the impact of the home demolitions been so far?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, I mean, these are thousands and thousands of people they're the original inhabitants of the Negev Desert region, basically the southern third or so of the State of Israel. I mean, these are communities that were there before 1948 when Israel was established. Some of those communities were forcibly displaced in or soon after 1948 or at various periods in the intervening decades. And what's been happening since is basically the state, the various agencies of the state have attempted to move them sort of at will whenever they wish. Basically what happened was the core of the problem of the unrecognized villages is that in the mid-1960s, when Israel established a national planning commission, they zoned all the land in the country. I should back up and say, first of all, the state, unlike many societies in the West, the state controls something like 93% of the land. So land in Israel, for all purposes, for all practical purposes, is state land, and individuals can lease it for, you know, very long term, 99 years, something like this. But because of that state control, they were able to zone it, industrial, residential, agricultural, et cetera. And basically, starting in the 1960s, they just zoned vast areas of the Negev as agricultural, which meant that these communities, which had been living there in many cases for decades or were living on land that they had been forcibly displaced to, were at the stroke of a pen illegal. That is, the villages were unrecognized, which meant that the individuals, the families living in the villages, their shelters, their various structures were illegal and were therefore liable to be demolished.
And these are very poor people, right?
For the most part, they're extremely poor people. And in fact, even if you look at there are seven so-called recognized townships. These are these are the places that the state did construct or allowed Bedouin to move to and live in. These are where they're living legally. And the seven recognized townships are all of them are in the top sort of 10 poorest communities in Israel. So, yes, you're talking about a very, very impoverished community.
Is there any sort of recourse for villages to try to get permits to be recognized as legal or even homes? Do these villagers have any kind of legal recourse?
Well, they have tried, certainly over the decades, and particularly over the last decade. The problem is this: in many cases, the ownership, their ownership of the land or their long residency rights, don't take the form of a kind of a property deed, and this is the core of the problem. Some of them do have these actual property deeds, but most do not, and so when they try and challenge it in court, they basically have no, this is what the court recognizes, namely, a property deed. And if they don't have that, they've lost the case. So, in fact, they've learned, Bedouin have learned over the years that bringing it to court actually makes matters worse. Number one, the case is totally stacked against them. I mean, they have zero chance of winning any kind of reversal of a demolition order. And number two, they then sort of they're then liable for sort of criminal charges as well. They end up having to pay huge fines or even do time in jail. So they don't challenge it in court for the most part. Actually, just a few weeks ago, in early March, was the first time ever that a court, an Israeli court, has reversed a demolition order. And as you mentioned, we're talking about orders that came down in the hundreds in 2007 alone. So this is we don't know if this is simply an exceptional development or the start of it doesn't appear to be the start of a new policy on the part of the state. This is why we're calling for an independent mechanism to look into the situation and to recommend a comprehensive solution to the problem.
And I understand, Joe, according to your report, Jewish citizens are able to construct, whether legal or illegal, homes in the same area without facing any repercussions.
Well, that's right. We're talking about a problem that, if you want to sum it up in one word, it's discrimination, gross discrimination. And just in the demolition area alone, we see discrimination because, as you just mentioned, it's not illegal structures; it's illegal Bedouin structures or illegal Arab structures. When Jewish residents, Jewish citizens of Israel, construct homes or other structures, they seldom get demolition orders. Instead, they are simply ignored and allowed to continue, or they are retroactively legalized. If I could just make one other point, I mean,
sure.
Look, under international law, a state does have the right to forcibly evict people, to issue demolition orders in exceptional circumstances. But in when those exceptional circumstances apply, the state has to show, number one, an overriding public interest, sort of demanding that the radical course of action. And number two, it has to at least allow the individuals a meaningful process for challenging the demolition order and getting it obtained. And in none of these instances are these requirements met by the state of Israel.
But what about any kind of compensation?
Well, again, there's been completely inadequate compensation. Very often compensation is not available at all, or it's compensation that's offered. It's not really compensation. It's you might say enticements to move into these so-called recognized townships, but what they're offering is basically, they're not offering any land rights. They're offering very little by way of any kind of material compensation. And as I mentioned, these recognized townships, the conditions of life in there are so bad that frankly there just isn't any kind of incentive for people there to accept that kind of offer from the state.
Joe, where can listeners find out more about this report? Clearly, this is an issue that is little reported.
It is little reported, and it's an issue that, of course, it's a long-standing issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a problem for basically the last 60 years of the existence of the State of Israel, but it seems to be coming to something of a head right now. And in any case, in answer to your question, this report is available on our website, which is www.hrw.org, and on the homepage you will see a photo and
right.
Links to the report.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for calling.
Joe Stork is Middle East Director at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us live from Jerusalem. HRW.org is where you can get the report we've been discussing. And for Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Martin Luther King Jr., who once said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." That's MLK, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. On Monday, we will be featuring Immokalee workers who are traveling to Los Angeles live in studio. They're going to be speaking this Sunday, April 6th, with the from 12 noon to 6 p.m. at 1702 East 41st Street in L.A. You can check out our site, uprisingradio.org, for details. And Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Tamika Zoghi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our site, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Have a wonderful weekend, and thanks for listening.
Healthy People, Healthy Planet, Climate Change in LA is a community event being held to help promote awareness on climate change and other related emergencies. The event is to help increase awareness on emergency-related events.